with distribution. So I have one last operation to discuss with you, and that is composition with a function. Okay, so how can we define the composition of a distribution with a function? So again, we can try to take inspiration from the distributions that are functions and write this as an integral. Now, if we want to make a general definition so that this is well-defined for all distributions, we can try to make a change of variables. So if we do that, y equals f of x, then we'll be left with u of y times phi of y inverse and a change of variables factor coming from this. And we need all that other stuff to be a test function. So that's, in general, not going to be a test function if for arbitrary f. So in general, composition is not well-defined. For a general function f, we need to place some restrictions on f in order to make sure that this expression makes sense. So I'll tell you about two cases in which we can make sense of composition. So first of all, first is the general case, and then we can make specific definitions for specific distributions. So this is only guaranteed to exist if, so we need to impose a few conditions. First of all, we need f to be continuous and infinitely differentiable. Second, we need this equation, y equals f of x, to have a unique solution. X equals g of y for all y. And finally, we need g prime of y not to change sign. So with these restrictions on f, we're guaranteed that u composed with f, phi, can be written like this, as u of y, phi of g of y, that's the value of g prime y, dy, and with these assumptions, we're guaranteed that this is a test function. And in that case, we can make this a definition. And we don't have to worry about whether or not u is a function or a more general distribution. So with these restrictions, we can make this this definition so that this is.
What do you mean by g prime doesn't change sign?
So either
it's monotonic?
Yes, so I mean that the function is monotonic.
Okay.
And the derivative never vanishes. So it's either always positive or always negative.
Why is that a condition for that to be test function?
Like, what would happen if g prime changed sign?
If g prime changed sign, this could be zero. And yeah, so so one example would be a function like x squared. So if we try to define delta of x squared, as you'll see from the formula we'll define in a minute, it just doesn't make sense.
What is important, the absolute value?
The absolute value?
You've written one of g prime of y.
Yeah, so I need
to check with you.
Yeah, check it. Just from the change of variables.
Oh, okay, it should be there.
Okay, so.
And one more thing, how does having f as being a continuously as being continuous and infinitely differentiable help? I mean, why, if f is c infinity, how does it help with our definition? How does it guarantee the existence of the composition?
So with these conditions, I'm not going to prove it, but you can show that this combination here is a test function. So these conditions guarantee that this is a test function for arbitrary phi. I don't want to go into that proof, but that's the essential reason why we need. This is too strong in many cases, but in general cases, this guarantees that that's a test function. Okay, so for specific distributions, we can relax some of these assumptions. And the most important distribution is the delta, so it's worth doing that. So I want to compose delta with a function f. We can make the definition that this is the sum over the roots of f of delta xi over absolute value of f prime xi of phi. So here the sum is over the roots of f. And the only condition we need to impose on f is that f has only simple roots. And so this is by far the most important formula for composition. Yes, Emily?
If you do that, is delta there being regarded as a distribution or a function?
Delta here is being regarded as a distribution. So this f
is f a function or a distribution?
F is a function.
F is a function. Sorry. Okay.
Is a function. Delta is a distribution.
Then we shouldn't ask also that f goes to infinity or minus infinity when the function goes to infinity or minus infinity as x goes to infinity and minus infinity in order
for the
limits
one?
To be. The integration limits from minus infinity and infinity depend on the function.
Oh, yeah, yes, those. Yeah, in general, those can be different. Okay. So I just want to summarize what we've learned about distribution with a list of warnings. When do you have to be careful when you're using distributions? So first of all, This is only defined if phi is a test function. So this is how we defined distributions in the first place. And it doesn't, in general, make sense to act with a distribution on an arbitrary function. Second, we saw that multiplication is defined psi is continuous and infinitely differentiable. So we could allow somewhat more general functions for multiplication than we could for than if we wanted to compute the inner product. As we just saw, composition is generally difficult to define. And finally, everything we've been discussing is a linear theory of distributions. Nonlinear theory of distributions is not a well-understood subject and in general not well-defined. So there's no sense in which we can multiply distributions in a well-defined manner. And although they're sometimes applied to nonlinear differential equations, you have to be very careful. Things don't always, aren't always well-defined. Any other questions on distributions before we move on?
There's no natural operation I can do between two distributions, right? I mean, I cannot make the composition of a distribution with another distribution.
In general, no. In specific cases, you can define certain things, but define it with additional assumptions. Sometimes you can make it make sense, but in general, no. For instance, delta squared doesn't make sense.
Sorry, the delta xi, and this is written as
the
shorthand for delta bracket x minus xi.
Right. So this delta xi acting on a function is that test function at xi. Okay. Now we're going to change directions somewhat and talk about orthogonal functions. So my plan for the rest of the lecture is I'll talk first about Sturm-Liouville theory. Parseval's theorem. And finally, we'll start our discussion of orthogonal polynomials. And so this will begin the special functions part of the course. So there are some connections between the two, but you'll maybe see some of those in David's course next week. I won't get into that. But my goal is really to teach you about some of the general properties of classes of special functions and the techniques you need to use to identify when you should use these special functions and techniques for manipulating those. So I'll discuss some of those in lecture. You'll see some more in tutorial. So this is a very broad subject. I can't cover everything, but I'm just going to try to discuss things that are most relevant for physics. And of course, and the things you should really know. Oftentimes, when the first thing you do if you're looking at a problem that involves special functions is go look at a reference, and I encourage you to do that. But there are certain properties and certain tools you should know you have at your disposal. And so that's my goal for the next few lectures is to talk about general properties and which tools you have at your disposal when you're working with these special functions. OK. So our topic for the next hour or so will be orthogonal functions. So when might you want to use these? So one case that comes up very frequently is separation of variables. And I just want to remind you very briefly about the types of differential equations you'll commonly get when you use separation of variables. So let's start by looking at Laplace's equation. And in spherical coordinates, this reads how can we solve this equation? The simplest way is to make an ansatz that phi is the product of two functions, one of which depends only on the radial variable, r, and the second of which depends on the angular variables only. And if we plug this in to our equation here, what we get is the following equation that has two terms, one of which depends only on our function r and the variable r, and the other of which has a part that is independent, that depends only on theta and phi. And so we see that since this first term depends only on r, it's independent of theta and phi, the only way this equation can have a consistent solution is if this term is independent of theta and phi as well. So that means that we have to have L squared y is equal to a constant times y. And we can call this constant L times L plus 1, where this constant is what's known as a separation constant.
Bracket on the second line, it's 1 over r squared times what's inside? It's,
yeah. Yeah, 1 over y. This is y. This is L squared y. So what does this leave us with? This just gives us equation like this. So this is an example of what's known as a Sturm-Liouville equation. And we can think of this as an eigenvalue problem. So in general, we might want to solve an equation of this form. So this is a particular example here. We have some differential operator that acts on a function r. And so we have one term that's a differential operator acting on the function r, and a second term that is some eigenvalues multiplying a function times r, the same function r. So this type of problem is in many ways analogous to eigenvalue problems you've solved in finite dimensions, where you may have a matrix, and you want to find the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. So the difference here is now that instead of a matrix, we have a differential operator. Instead of a eigenvector, we have eigenfunctions, which are infinite dimensional analogs, and eigenvalues. So we know that if the matrix is Hermitian, the eigenvectors will be orthogonal. And so something analogous happens here. When we have the eigenfunctions will be analogous if this differential operator is Hermitian, or self-adjoint. And so we're going to see under what conditions that happens. There's some subtleties because we're in an infinite dimensional case. But in many ways, it's very analogous to what you've already learned about finite dimensional problems. So and the subtleties arise because of the boundary conditions. So let's suppose we want to solve this in some interval. Where A and B could either be finite real numbers or plus or minus infinity. Yes,
Heather? When you say do we assume that we have some kind of metric then on the functions?
Yes, I will be more precise about all those things in a few minutes. A metric, yes.
Okay.
To preview things, this W is going to be what's known as the weight. What you're asking about. Okay, so since we're interested in orthogonal functions, let's figure out which solutions of this equation are orthogonal. So to do that, we can multiply this equation by a different eigenfunction, u lambda, and integrate. If we do that, we get this equation. I'll move this term over to the other side. And we can start with this equation for u lambda prime instead of u lambda, and then subtract the two. So we do the similarly starting with equation for u lambda prime. We get almost the same thing. And we can subtract these two equations to get And so, U and U lambda prime, yes.
You're assuming here that the differential operator is self-adjoint, but in general, it wouldn't be, right?
In general, it wouldn't be. So where if I assume that?
This only applies to the case where the differential operator is self-adjoint, or can you use this to solve more?
So far, I've just assumed that this equation holds. That's the only assumption I've made so far. I will make additional assumptions in a few minutes, but everything I've written on this board only assumes that this equation is true. Yes.
Some other eigenfunction. Okay. Got it.
Okay. So, what do we see here? So, this is almost what we would mean by if this integral here were zero. That's almost what we'd mean by U lambda and U lambda prime being orthogonal. We have this extra function here, W.
One thing, you're assuming that U's are real?
Yes, I'm assuming they're real.
And so we also assume that the omega was self-adjoint, right? Or did we not?
No,
we did not.
We just multiplied the second equation on the right.
Right. Left. But the thing is that if you want that to be kind of an inner product between the two functions, in order for it to be well defined, both of them have to be real, right? And that you're right hand part of.
Yes, I'm assuming here that they're real.
All right.
Okay.
In the case where you consider complex solutions, you can make the same thing same process, but instead of having omega in the second one, it's omega.
That's right. We'd have to take
U lambda is a real.
Yes. So this is what we can call the inner product between U lambda prime and U lambda with respect to the weight W. So here, W of X is the weight. And so this defines an inner product in L2 AB with a weight W. So it's a slight generalization of the Hilbert spaces we were talking about before. And so, in general, there'd be a star here, but I'm just going to deal with the real case. So this inner product, so these two functions are orthogonal. This inner product is zero with respect to this weight for lambda not equal to lambda prime if this expression on the left-hand side is zero. So, that's if U lambda omega U lambda prime is equal to omega U lambda U lambda prime. And so this is what we mean by an operator being, so omega is self-adjoint, if this is true, or Hermitian.
Sorry, are you defining orthogonality or being self-adjoint here?
This is self-adjointness.
Self-adjoint.
Right. So these are orthogonal.
Yes. If this is true.
Well, if this is true, this side is zero.
Okay.
And therefore, these are orthogonal. This is not the definition of orthogonal. The definition of orthogonal is that this is equal to zero. So this here means U lambda prime and U lambda are orthogonal. That's the definition of orthogonal. Yes?
What exactly is the weight good for? Because we can just get rid of it by substitute, by kind of absorbing it into the U, can't we? And then we have an inner product without a weight.
So you make take a root W into each of the...
I think part of the problem is
that the right hand and the left hand side are different inner, mm-hmm. are using different inner products.
No, they're not.
So you have to have a W in one of them.
One is a
root. So I mean, you have to rescale the operator by root W as well, or one over root W. Right?
Yeah, we could do that. We would change this side too then. So we get a function over here. These two equations are with respect to the weight one. So we have a weight on one side or the other. It's a choice of which side we put it on. It's conventional to put it on that side, but could move it over to the other side.
We could just do change variables to get rid of it, but a lot of times, so you could do change variables to get rid of the W, but I think that you just have an equivalent L2 space. Like, you have an L2 space of functions with a certain weight, and then another L2 space with no weight, where the weight of one. And just sometimes it's more convenient to think about it with a
You're basically, if by doing time. That, you're normalizing it with respect to W.
There are some conditions.
So is it the idea that the two U's are orthogonal in this particular L space, and it follows that the operator is similar to it everywhere?
Not renormalized.
Right. Important example of a self-adjoint operator is the second order form, known as the Sturm-Liouville form. And so it can be shown that F omega G minus omega F G is equal to S F G prime minus G F prime. So this can be shown just by integration by parts. And so this operator is self-adjoint as long as we impose boundary conditions so that this is zero. So if we do that, then this is self-adjoint, and it follows that the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Eigenvalues are real. The eigenvectors are orthogonal in exactly the same way you learned about for Hermitian, finite dimensional Hermitian matrices. Yes, Brody?
So where you define the orthogonality with the weight, should, and you say it's equal to zero, should that be like a delta of lambda prime lambda?
Yes. Thank you.
Or possibly with some normalization.
Basically,
can multiply this stuff with a link.
Self-adjointness of the operator depends on the boundary conditions.
That's right.
That satisfy S of X, right? It's independent of F on the
U
prime.
You can imagine that.
I mean, you're saying that you can show that that it's valid for all F and G, right?
The same
thing.
So
the same thing.
So it's what's known as formally self-adjoint. If we can, if it satisfies this for all F and G subject to certain boundary conditions, we can impose boundary conditions on F and G. So this inner product doesn't make sense for all F and G that are in L2. For a general element of L2, if we act as the differential operator, it might not be in L2 anymore. So we have to restrict the domain of our differential operator. So it's already restricted just by this equation. We can impose further restrictions by imposing boundary conditions on the functions f and g. And as long as the domain of omega is the same, whether it's acting on f or g, then this is self-adjoint. So the simplest case, so here, important point is that self-adjointness depends on boundary conditions. So the simplest case is we can impose separated boundary conditions. And that means we'll demand that S F G prime minus G F prime is zero at A and B separately. Okay. So simplest case is when both A and B are finite. And in that case, and S is positive. So if S is positive and A and B are finite, we can impose boundary conditions alpha 1 U lambda at A plus alpha 2 U lambda prime at A is 0, and similarly at B. We need to impose this condition to make the domains match. I'm not going to explain that much in more detail. So if we impose these boundary conditions, this expression here is 0. And these are this operator is self-adjoint. So in that case, we can show that the eigenvalues are real and distinct. And there's the smallest eigenvalue. they form a semi-infinite sequence. Can also show that an appropriate choice for normalization, un form an orthonormal basis. Of this space.
Sorry, is are these things existing now true only if with
yes.
particular boundary conditions?
If yes, with this choice of boundary conditions, we have these two. So these two are exactly what we'd expect based on our experience with finite dimensional matrices. We also have. Two other results. Zeros of the n plus first eigenfunction are in between the zeros of the nth eigenfunction. And u lambda n has exactly n distinct zeros in AB. So these last two are what's known as Sturm's separation and Sturm's comparison theorem. That follow from that. So the power of this is that we can learn a lot about solutions to these type of differential equations without doing any work. We don't even have to solve it. We know we can sketch a reasonably accurate plot of the qualitative features of these solutions.
Okay. So if zeros of u lambda n plus 1 are between those of u lambda n, so as we go to higher n's, does that mean that the functions start to overlap almost? Is that what it implies?
So, for instance, if we have a differential equation of this type that satisfies these boundary conditions, we can sketch a plot of what it looks like. So, for instance, suppose we know we're posing these boundary conditions at 1 and minus 1. So we know that the first a qualitative plot, we might get some of the scale wrong. We know that the first eigenfunction has no zeros, so it's going to look something like this. The next one has to have one zero, so maybe it looks like this. If we knew something about the symmetry of the problem, we could maybe say that it has to be at zero. The next eigenfunction has to have exactly two zeros. One has to be in between this zero and boundary, the other one has to be between this zero and the other boundary. So U2 might look something like this. Emma?
The eigenfunctions ordered, is it in terms of increasing value of the eigenvalue?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Based on this order, there's a smallest one. So if S were negative, there would be a largest one.
Assuming somehow that this spectrum is discrete?
Nope. That follows. It follows. It follows from these assumptions.
Correct.
Okay. And the first three points hold more generally. Hold even if S of x equals 0 at A or B, or A or over B is infinite. So in these cases, we don't have to impose boundary conditions at A or B, depending on if S is 0 at A or B is infinite. Just demanding that the function is in L2 as a square integrable or finite will be enough in general. So in this case, we just need to. And U lambda is finite at A or B. And here we need to demand that root W U lambda goes to 0 and X goes to plus or minus infinity. Yes. Okay. So all this holds assuming that we have a differential operator in that form. We're not always given a differential operator in that form. But the little work we can usually put the operator, differential operator in that form. So let's suppose we're given the equation h double prime minus 2x h prime is equal to minus 2 h lambda. So that's not of the form we have over there. What we can do is we can multiply our Sturm-Liouville equation by some function g to try to put it in that form. And we compare our operator over there with our equation here, we see that S of x has to be equal to g of x. S prime of x has to be equal to minus 2x times g of x, but that's also equal to g prime of x by differentiating the first equation. So this gives us a differential equation for the factor we have to multiply our equation by to put it in Sturm-Liouville form. And if we solve that equation, we get that g of x is e to the minus x squared. And so if we multiply this equation by e to the minus x squared, we can see that the weight with which these eigenfunctions are orthogonal with respect to is given by e to the minus x squared. In a second.
G?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is not of the form we wanted. So
and the form we want
is this. This equation with that differential operator here. So if we write this out, this is G So over here, we see that we act with this on some function u. We have s is the coefficient of the second derivative term. And S prime is the coefficient of the first derivative term. Okay. So that's Sturm-Liouville theory.
I'm sorry, where did you get the minus 2x gx? You fixed that, or?
So that's the coefficient here.
Ah, okay.
So I motivated this as coming from separation of variables, but these types of problems also occur all the time in quantum mechanics. Hermitian operators are just observables, so important for that reason as well. One other reason that orthogonal functions are important is for approximation.
Yeah.
I just showed that even if you're given a eigenvalue problem, it's not apparently in the form that we've been discussing. With a little bit of work by multiplying by some function, you can usually put it in that form. So it's more general than it might have seemed given the differential operator I wrote down. That's right.
So you're multiplying basically by an integration factor, right? So that you can shrink everything into one derivative.
That's right. Okay, so it's common in physics that we want to approximate functions. And this is particularly simple if we have a set of orthogonal functions. So we want to approximate a function f given a set of orthogonal functions, un. You can show that the best approximation, if we want to minimize, our goal is to minimize the square error distance in L2 between f and its approximation, then the best choice of the ans is just the inner product of un with f. And you can show that in just a few lines by expanding this out. I'm not going to do that. And the minimum value is the norm of f squared minus the sum of an squared. And so
is that the L2 inner product or the weighted inner product? Since un are only orthogonal with
right, so this works. If we want to add a weight here, we can add a weight
on the agens. So you're making an expansion in terms of a finite number of un's, right? You have an order basis of L2W, right?
That's right.
Okay, so you, I can choose it however I want to.
The order? Yes.
Yeah.
So you can choose the order however you want. The approximation may depend on which order you. How good your approximation may depend on the order, but given the set of orthogonal functions you're using, or orthonormal functions, then this is the best approximation.
So if I have an infinite sum, I can always do that, right? Because it forms a basis of the space.
Yes, yes, very good. And that result is what's known as Parsonage theorem, which is just about to get to.
Am I guaranteed by some theorem or something that delta n will get smaller as I add more terms?
You are. That is guaranteed by Parseval's theorem, which I'm just about to describe. So Parseval's theorem. Says that if the norm of F is finite, then delta n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So the sum converges. Equivalently, F squared is equal to n equals 1 to infinity.
Does norm is in the weighted space?
Yeah, we can always put a weight here.
Should that be n
times
infinity?
Yes, infinity. Thanks. Okay. So, let's look at an example of how to use this. I think it's fun. And it'll connect us to one of the functions we're going to talk about tomorrow. So and this result is perhaps more obvious if we think about a physical application. So let's consider a wave with amplitude f of x and period L. And if we expand in the orthonormal set of functions that are just the 2 pi inx over L, so if we expand it in a Fourier series, then Parseval's theorem just tells us that the total energy is equal to the sum of the energy in the Fourier components. And let's see how this works. Suppose f of x is just x. So we're looking at a function here that's periodic, period L. And Parseval's theorem tells us that 1 over L is the integral minus L over 2 to L over 2 of F squared is equal to the sum minus infinity to infinity of A n squared. And so this left-hand side can evaluate as just 1 over L. This integral is the integral of x squared dx, which is equal to L squared over 12. Now, before we can evaluate the right-hand side, we need to evaluate the ANs. So first of all, A0 is 0 by symmetry. And for n not equal to 0, an is 1 over L, integral from minus L over 2 to L over 2, x e to the minus 2 pi in x over L. And so we can evaluate this by inserting a derivative here. And we get minus 1 over 2 pi I n. We just inserted a derivative on the exponential term. And now we can integrate by parts to get okay, and so this last term vanishes by symmetry. And if we evaluate this, and we just get that this is equal to L over 2 pi in times minus 1, the n plus 1. So if we put that in over here, we get L squared over 2 pi n squared. And rewriting, bring out some prefactors, we get L squared over 4 pi squared. This and not equal to 0. And we'll get a 2 because the sums from minus infinity to minus 1 is the same as from 1 to infinity. And canceling out common factors, we get pi squared over 6 is equal to this sum. Which, as we'll see tomorrow, is the zeta function evaluated at 2. So we get an exact value of the zeta function. I'll lift that up. Non-trivial identity.
I think the choice of your inner product, the limits of integration, is somehow arbitrary. I can take it from 0 to L instead of minus L half to L.
That's right. Could have changed that. Okay. Okay, so one important class of orthogonal functions are the orthogonal polynomials. Probably the three most important are the orthogonal polynomials, the Bessel functions, which you'll see in tutorial today, and the these exponentials. So it's worth understanding the orthogonal polynomials a little bit better. And for the last part of today, I'll derive a few of their properties, and tomorrow we'll classify them so you can understand how they're all connected. So how can we construct these? The simplest way is to use the fact that polynomials form a basis of L2W. I'm not going to prove that, but it's true. And given this, we can construct an orthonormal set using the standard Gram-Schmidt procedure. So if we start with a degree zero polynomial, we can just take to be constant. We can choose to be 1 divided by the norm of that constant. So that gives us a polynomial of degree 0 with unit norm. And we can, given we have 1, given we have a set of n of these polynomials, we can construct a polynomial of degree n plus 1 from the polynomials of degree 0 through n by first starting with a polynomial that has degree n plus 1, which we can just take as x times one we've already constructed with degree n, and subtract off the component of this polynomial in the direction of all of the other polynomials. And if we want to normalize it, we can divide by a normalization factor, which is just the norm of the numerator. Okay, so that's a simple way to construct them. What have we learned? One thing we can read off from this with just a few lines of work is that these polynomials satisfy recurrence relations. And these are important for manipulating these polynomials, practical problems. So see that. Let's look at this expression here. So pi with xpn is the integral ab of w times pi xpn, which if we just group things differently, we can see is instead of grouping the x with pn, we group it with pi. So this is equal to x pi with pn. And so by construction, pn is orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n. So that means that this is equal to 0 for I is equal to 0 all the way up to n minus 2. Because this has to be, pi has to be, if pi is n minus 1, then it, these are the same degree, and it's not necessarily orthogonal. But if it's anything less, then it's orthogonal. So this sum is not really a sum from 0 to n. It's a sum from n minus 1 to n. So there's only two terms in the sum. And that tells us that pn plus 1 is equal to an x bn plus bn pn plus cn pn minus 1, where these are just some constants that can read off from here. So this is what's known as a recurrence relation, and all of the orthogonal polynomials satisfy one. Okay. Are there any questions? Okay, so tomorrow we'll classify the orthogonal polynomials and discuss a few of the other important special functions in physics. In particular, we'll spend most of the rest of the lecture on the gamma function. Also discuss briefly the zeta and hypergeometric functions. So see you tomorrow.